little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelich, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, I'm excited about this topic because it's something that I've been thinking about for years. And in fact, Julia and I did on one of our early episodes, we did a superficial introduction to the topic, and we called it the elephant in the room of critical thinking. And so it's very important for our listeners. I think it's a huge topic for anyone interested in critical thinking. And Julia is going to tell you more about the specific topics that we're going to get into.
Today, we're going to be digging into something really kind of interesting. And as Bob said, something we've just dabbled in before, but are going to take a deep dive. Topics for this episode include conceptualizing the idea of worldview, how our worldview might affect our beliefs and behaviors, what types of worldviews have been described by a study in worldviews, methods of uncovering our own worldview and the worldview of others we communicate with, how an awareness of worldview can improve our dialogues and resources for learning more about worldviews and each other.
And with a bachelor's degree in psychology, a master's degree in social environmental sciences, and a PhD in worldviews and sustainable development, our guest, Anik DeWitt, developed the worldview test based on her doctoral dissertation research at VU University in the Netherlands, and founded Worldview Journeys, an organization that has the mission to, and this is a quote, support people to explore, exchange, and expand their worldviews, empowering them to enact a better world, end quote. As a researcher, writer, and teacher, Anik describes her personal mission as to contribute to the psychological growth and cultural transformation needed for fostering more sustainable, just, and generative societies. Anik DeWitt, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you, Bob and Julia. Great to be here.
Well, thanks so much for joining us all the way from the Netherlands. Really appreciate it.
Yes.
So we're digging into worldviews today, and, you know, it's an interest that's probably not a common choice for a lot of people, especially as a grad school academic specialty. Really curious, what drew you to your focus on worldviews and to the relationship of worldviews to, as Bob described, a cultural transformation needed for fostering more sustainable, just, and generative societies?
Yes, great question. Thank you. Yeah, so it's a long story and it has many turns, but the essence is that I kind of became really concerned about the environment when I was a kid, so like 8 years old. This is in the 80s. Lots is going on in the world, and I'm becoming concerned. Later on, after my bachelor's in psychology, I decide to kind of transfer to social environmental studies or social environmental sciences. So this is a field where we really look at environmental problems, ecological problems, or sustainability problems, whatever you want to call them. Through a social science lens, with the aim of understanding also that this is a social problem, right? This is a socially created problem, understanding it in more depth and also being able to foster and support social change in the direction of a more sustainable society. And in these studies, I got very fascinated by the thinking of environmental philosophers. And environmental philosophers, as philosophers and are supposed to, tend to not agree on very much. But I noticed that when I looked into the thought of many different people and many different interesting thinkers, that they all seem to point to worldview as fundamental to our ecological crisis, if you will. So this is the idea that this crisis, these environmental problems, are actually kind of a manifestation or an expression of how we understand the world, how we relate to the world, how we understand and see nature, and how we relate to nature. And so they often tend to say worldviews are the root cause of our crises. And I think actually environmental philosophers, you know, this is a couple of decades ago, we're talking very specifically about this ecological crisis. But this counts, I think, for many of our crises today. But if we actually dig a little deeper, we find that our worldviews are the source of how we, or at least a very important source of how we act and behave and choose and prioritize in our world. And so they are very central both to understanding these problems as well as to crafting new pathways forward to start addressing them. So this is how I became really interested in worldviews and ended up doing a dissertation on the topic.
Complex word, really, worldviews, because it can be used in a lot of different fields and venues, everything from philosophy to cognitive science, and now you're including environmental studies. So it has a multitude of meanings. When I've looked into worldviews, I see a lot of different definitions and descriptions of worldview. How do you specifically conceptualize worldview?
So one way that I like to look at worldviews is that worldviews are the kind of existential meaning-making frameworks that we use to make sense of our experience as human beings living in this world, make sense of our personal experience, and make sense of this larger world that we live in. And you could say that worldviews actually answer these existential life questions for us that humans have been pondering probably since the beginning of time. So these are questions like, you know, what is this reality? Really, what is this complex and mysterious reality that we find ourselves in? And how can we come to knowledge of it? How do we know that what we believe is true? And who are we as creatures? What kind of creatures are we? And what are we doing here? Now, what is our purpose here? Or is there no such thing? What is our relationship to nature? And how should we live with one another? How should we organize our collective living, our societies? And so worldviews answer these really kind of fundamental questions for us in kind of a somewhat coherent, somewhat logical, though they contain also a lot of contradictions generally, but in a somewhat coherent story that we operate from. So this worldview tends to be quite implicit and unconscious. It's really the point that we start from. It's the what we assume, it's what we presume, rather than that we're very consciously thinking about it, generally speaking.
For me, it forms the basis of our personal philosophy, and it's a starting point. I was talking to Julia before we started the recording here, and I kind of relate it to things that we've talked about before on this show, but we didn't call it worldview. We talked about predictive processing in cognitive science, where we build a map of the world in our head. We have our own personal perceptions of what's out there, our ontology, if you want to give it a philosophical term, and what's true, what is real knowledge, our epistemology, again, if you want to use the philosophical term, you know, that links to our worldview. I'm so glad that you mentioned that it's implicit, because in my way of thinking, and since I've been interested in worldview, I've been interested in trying to uncover all the facets of my own worldview. You know, another way of saying it is sometimes it's our cognitive biases. So it really links to a lot of different aspects of what we've talked about on this show.
It's a very comprehensive concept.
Yeah. I have background in being a counselor, and I know I had clients who would come sometimes and they would want to change something in their life. And they would start thinking about, well, I need to experience what God wants me to do. I need to pray on this and experience what God wants me to do. And I began realizing that that was very different from my worldview.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And my working as a counselor. And so I had to find a way to deal with those situations. And that's really what kindled my initial interest in worldview. Do I need to refer this person to another person who may have another more theological, religious worldview? Or can I work effectively for that person? So I would hear things like, there's a God, and the Bible reveals God's word, and therefore I'll look to the scriptures for guidance. Where my worldview, I might say something like logic-driven thinking based on a robust cross-section of relevant evidence, which I've said many times in this program, provides the most accurate method of assessing the truth. So I'll use critical thinking to form my beliefs. You know, it's a very basic, as you described it, a very basic fundamental philosophy or set of beliefs.
Yes, absolutely. And as you pointed out with your example of the therapy, worldviews are really so important for us to have a sense of, give us a sense of meaning in life. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you look back at, for example, Max Weber, you know, one of the founders of the field of sociology, he argued that this was actually the central function of worldview, to give us a sense that life is meaningful, that we can manage it, that it is stable. And so it is very, these frameworks of meaning, though they are implicit, they really orient us in, yeah, I would be inclined to say in pretty much everything we do. Mm-hmm. It is that fundamental and it is that comprehensive, and that also makes that what you touched on before, that this concept bridges a lot of fields. So it has these philosophical dimensions, but it's also very psychological. You mentioned neuroscience and cognitive bias, but it's also related to behavior. It comes to expression in our culture, in our political struggles, and has also great applicability for that reason. And that is also, again, what connects it to our contemporary problems, our environmental problems, and all our other crises. Mm-hmm. And that's also where we see societally more interest emerging. Some people are starting to say, we need a new worldview. We need to start looking at things differently in order to address the problems that we're confronted with. But that's maybe jumping ahead, but
Yeah, something you said really kind of stuck with me, which was the underlying presumptions. You know, I think if you were to ask someone, you know, what is your worldview, they're probably not even thinking about, you know, this is my worldview. Or they would say, I am a Christian, I am a woman, I am middle-aged, you know, as part of our identity. And we don't often kind of reflect that these are ways in which we view the world. I'm really curious, in your models of worldview, you kind of describe four categories of worldview, which I'm sure there's a lot to them, but breaking it down into four categories kind of, I think, makes it like a good place to start, a little digestible. Yes. Can you kind of briefly describe these for us? We have a traditional worldview, modern worldview, postmodern worldview, and integrative worldviews.
Is to say that these are not necessarily my worldview. I really looked at in a kind of broad and comprehensive overarching way at, you know, what philosophers had said and thought about this, and what we know in sociology from how values change over time. And so I looked at all these bodies of work, came to the realization that we could also conceptualize these as actual worldviews. For example, we talk a lot about modernity and modernism. And modernism is the kind of intellectual movement that underlies modernity, which is, a period in time, an epoch. But it kind of crystallizes. It comes together in the modern worldview. So to go briefly through these four, so the traditional worldview, and that's the interesting thing, I think, also about these four worldviews, particularly the first three, they're quite common sense, actually. So you probably, when I say traditional worldview, you already know most about that worldview, because it's quite present in society. So traditional worldviews tend to be more religion-based worldviews, strongly associated with the great monotheistic religions, so with a more transcendental vision of the divine. So God created the world, but is above and is outside of that world. So that's already differentiated very strongly from more indigenous perspectives, for example, which see the divine as present in all of the world itself. So here you see, you get that kind of separation is more theistic, transcendental view. You get a more generally socially oriented worldview, very much to the family, to the community, to the religious community or local community or the national community. There's that kind of group, kind of emphasis on the social group, which brings a lot of strength and social traditional values, but also brings a certain conformism, for example. And then you get at some point, you get a shift to a more modern worldview where the emphasis changes and where in some sense there's also a response to the shortcomings or the limitations. So these worldviews exist in dynamic co-relation. They respond to each other and they build forth on each other. And so the modern worldview really starts to emphasize science and technology and, you know, this kind of think for yourself and kind of, you know, empirical science and experiment. And we're going to, instead of getting the truth, through the religious books or the religious revelation or through the religious leaders or traditional conventions, you know, we find the truth out for ourselves. We're going to do the actual research and, you know, start it particularly with the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment. And this is also a worldview that we all know. You know, there's a great emphasis on the autonomy and the dignity of the individual. You get this all this strong individualism. You get a more hedonistic and more materialistic value set. And then particularly since the 1960s, we start to see on a larger scale a shift to more postmodern worldviews. On the one hand, arising out of, a discontent and a criticism of also the problems that modernity, you know, next to all its progress, all the problems that it had generated. And so we get it's postmodern, we get a very modern critical perspective. It starts to question this objectivity of science. Does this actually exist? Can we understand ourselves as outsiders to this objective reality that we're observing? Is that even possible? It starts to question notions of rationality, of truth, of universal knowledge. And it comes with very different answers. You know, it starts to emphasize constructivism, and pluralism, relativism, certain cosmopolitanism or multiculturalism. It starts to emphasize other ways of knowing, and it coincides with a change in values to what is often referred to as self-expression values, or from material to more post-material values. Or you could describe it as a shift from welfare to well-being. And then the fourth worldview, and yeah, there's so much more to say about this, so I'm happy to go in deeper there with you, but I'll give you a little bit of the very small version now. So the fourth worldview starts to try to bring things together again. Get a lot of fragmentation in this postmodern worldview, and a lot of polarization, as we also see in our climate today very, very strongly. And so the integrative worldview starts to try to bring these together again and start to also kind of integrate the insights and the truths that have been cultivated and collected in these different worldviews in a larger perspective. And so it wants to integrate, unify science and spirituality, or science and religion, if you will. And it wants to, in some sense, integrate or bring together again humanity and nature, or economy and ecology. It's this really integrative impulse.
That's a great description of the four: the traditional, modern, postmodern and integrative. If we were to go back to Bob's example of being a counselor and being with someone being counseled, the person you're talking about who would seek insight from whether God, traditional texts, or I think we're using a lot of religious framing, it sounds like it could also be sort of traditional cultural expectations, societal
Absolutely.
Expectations.
Yeah.
That would be the traditional worldview person.
Yes.
And then that sounds like that is not Bob.
He
does not have the traditional worldview. So I don't know. I mean, I've definitely pointed out at times that Bob can be a bit of a materialist. You're very materially oriented. And correct me if I'm wrong, Bob. I mean, there's a lot more to you than that.
I like the term physicalist because when you use the term materialist, it makes me think of Madonna. You know, I'm a material
guy. You're just a material
girl.
Guy.
Material guy.
Yeah.
So physicalist being that there is an actual reality out there, physical reality, you know, and physics is the way we study that. And that's the best approach, the scientific approach. And so, I'll cop to that.
Fiscalism would say that there's only that, as I understand it. So indeed, it recognizes that this objective, material, physical, mechanical reality, if you will. But it has a tendency to say that, and this is the modern worldview for you, you know, it has a tendency to say like what we cannot empirically measure or calculate or prove doesn't exist. And so there's a whole world out there that in other worldviews is considered very important that it doesn't quite recognize. And this is why sometimes it's spoken of like the reductionism of the modern worldview and of a perspective like fiscalism.
I could see how that would really be a juxtaposition with someone who is traditional, has a traditional worldview versus the physicalist modern worldview, those being two things that are hard to sort of find to reconcile together. Exactly.
Yeah.
The
Sorry.
One thing I'd say about that is that putting this down into how I understand the world is that the fact that we cannot measure it now doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but we kind of hold it in abeyance. Because physics has found ways of measuring things that we never even knew existed. And so there's always
True.
That, but that if it is in the world, the idea that in this universe that we're living in, that there are principles of behavior that are probably not going to be violated. I would go that far. But it doesn't mean necessarily if we can't measure it now that it doesn't exist. We may be able to find a way of measuring it later. And that's what science does. That's how it evolves, is it finds new ways of explaining and understanding what is being observed and the patterns that are out there in the universe.
Yes, I totally hear you. Someone critical of that perspective, though, may say, yes, but your larger framework overall, and I'm not necessarily saying you as you, Bob, but more in general, this kind of modern worldview or this fiscalist worldview, your general framework is mechanistic. And so this is also referred to sometimes as the hard problem of consciousness. How can we explain our experience as conscious, as meaning-making, as beings who are having an interior experience? How can we explain this within a mechanistic framework?
Sure. That's a big problem. It's certainly one of my chief interests is understanding the conscious experience. And boy, is that batted around a lot in philosophy, cognitive science, all aspects that we've talked about on this show. We had N.L. Seth on, who is, an expert in attempting to understand consciousness. We could take the whole show on getting off on the details of this, but I would just say very quickly that, yes, I will say that in my worldview, consciousness is something that will eventually be understood in terms of the complexity of which our brain is operating. The trillions of interconnections between our neurons in our brain are able to do amazing things. And one of those is consciousness. We don't come anywhere close to understanding how that's done yet. But yes, you're right on in terms of my worldview. I do not believe it is something we will never understand or something that's mystical, spiritual, beyond our ability to ever understand it. And it's one of the marvels of being able to think in those kinds of abstractions and those kinds of levels.
Yes.
We could spend, of course, the whole episode and 2 or 3 months after this talking about this. And it's so interesting. But let's go on a little bit here. We've begun to talk about what I'm going to ask about right now. And that is that a primary focus of this show is understanding how we arrive at our beliefs. So let's explore this relationship. And I think we've begun to do that just, through our discussion here. How do you view, though, the influence of worldviews informing our beliefs and affecting our behavior?
Yes, I would say that beliefs make up, to a great degree, our worldview. And so our worldviews consist of the beliefs that are really fundamental in how we actually understand the ontological nature of reality, kind of referring back to these existential questions that I posed before. At the same time, we can relate them, for example, to our political positions. So you can take any political position, and this is also so interesting about our kind of contemporary debate. We live in a time of culture wars, right? We have raging culture wars, and a lot of the discussion that we're having is not on the level of worldview, even though I would argue that's where the real conflict is, but it's on the level of a little bit more on the surface events and facts. So you may have a political debate, for example, about abortion, with arguments often pulling out facts, even though we actually live in completely different worlds, because that's the interesting thing. And I felt that we were kind of getting to that just before. You know, you see that each of these worldviews really represents a different kind of world. Yeah, so we have these discussions, we fight each other on these on the level of facts and political positions. But when we actually dive deeper, we can come to realize that we were not even aware that there's ideas or commitments, convictions that are lying underneath these positions that are driving these ideas. I hope I'm not saying this all very abstract.
No, I'm understanding that precisely. And in fact, reiterate a point that Julia made is that implicit in our worldview is probably, let me get your opinion on this, that part of our worldview, the very basic part, are assumptions that we make, unprovable assumptions.
Unprovable, absolutely, yeah.
But we got to start somewhere in making sense of this world. So it sort of morphs into these unprovable, you know, my unprovable assumption is that, we can pretty much explain and are in progress of doing that everything in terms of a mechanistic, maybe not deterministic, but mechanistic framework. One of the things I do want to get in here, though, is because I'm starting to relate worldview to a whole lot of other things that we've talked about and given a different name. We've talked about the Bayesian approach. It's a statistically valid way of updating our beliefs about something. But the weakness of the Bayesian approach is that we have some prior probability, and we're talking about probabilities, the probability that something is true or accurate. We start out with a prior probability, and then we examine and find new evidence that we haven't factored into that belief, and we use a statistical method, and this is down to actually an equation if you get precise about it, and that'll be a valid statistical method for updating our prior belief or our prior probability that something is true. So we're looking at new evidence and using a systematic way of updating our belief. That's what the Bayesian approach is. But in thinking about and doing the preparation for doing this episode, it just came to me that worldview is probably our Bayesian priors. So if someone is going to tell me something that violates the laws of physics as I understand them, I'm going to be very skeptical of that. It's going to take a great deal of evidence to convince me that belief is true if it violates the laws of physics in some way. You know, the Bayesian approach, the weakness of it is that there's no good formula for coming up with your priors. And so I would say that the priors are based on our worldview. What do you think about that idea?
I think that that sounds very right to me. It's what I also said before, right? It's these things that we operate from rather than that we reflect on them. It is our point of departure. And so, yeah, these are the things that we assume that structure and construct our world in a certain way, because they... And this is back to your question about the relation to behavior and how does it actually relate to how we show up in the world. As we assume these things, this gives us a sense of orientation and direction. This gives us a sense of what is true, what is valuable, what is moral, what is possible. And with that, it starts to kind of create or construct our world. And well, that has enormous impact, of course, when you're talking about behavior. So yeah, I like this. I'm not so familiar with the Bayesian approach, but I like this, how you sketch this.
So to dig in more about understanding our own worldviews, can you describe for our listeners the worldview test, as well as where they can find it and how that test is scored and helps uncover our worldviews and how we can dig in more to discovering our worldviews beyond this test?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So the worldview test actually came out of my research. And so when I started this dissertation, I was, you know, really also thinking about how do you research this? How do we actually go about this? I don't know. One of you said before, like if you ask someone, what is your worldview? They probably actually don't know. They will most likely not be able to come up with a good answer. Or a true answer in most cases. You know, there's many approaches in social sciences. I looked at philosophy and I kind of came to see, particularly again, these first three worldviews are widely recognized in philosophy and sociology, the modern, the traditional, the postmodern one, but also the integrative one actually has quite a basis, both in, particularly I would argue, in philosophy and the history of ideas, but also in empirical science increasingly. And so, you know, starting from these four worldviews, and that's actually another thing I'd like to say, is that when thinking of these worldviews, realize that these are, in sociology, they use the term ideal types. They're kind of logically constructed, kind of coherent, yeah, logically, rationally constructed types that as such do not really, often not exist in the messiness and the complexity of social reality. Yet they offer us a powerful heuristic to explore that complex reality with. So this is good to keep in mind. Think of it as an ideal type or an archetype. So starting from these four worldviews, I basically developed this somewhat simple survey where we use those questions that I asked in the beginning, you know, what is reality and how can we know reality? I use those questions to unpack what the different worldviews actually answer to these questions and put that in survey statements. And so you can take the worldview test because now we did the research, we had very good results, and we ended up putting it online. So you can go to our website, www.worldviewjourneys.com, and there you will find it. And you can just take this test in, well, say 15 minutes or so, and you'll be asked on these existential life questions where you stand. And you may not always find the perfect answer, but you will see that there's a diversity of questions and a diversity of answers there that may make you really think about, oh yeah, actually, yeah, how do I see this? What do I think that happens after death, for example? There's one question about that. Or, yeah, why is there suffering? How should we interpret suffering? There's a question about that. And so you go through these, and we had found in our statistical data that there are pretty clear patterns. We constructed these worldviews in terms of these statements, and then we found them actually back in the data. We saw that people indeed who scored one question, say the traditional worldview, they were more likely to do that also for other questions. And then we also connected that to behavior. I looked at behavior in terms of climate change, climate concern, and voting behavior, and environmental behaviors, because that was, of course, the focus of my study. And we found relationships. We could see that people who scored high on a certain worldview would be more or less concerned about climate change, which is something that, you know, common sense could probably also tell you. But it was really interesting to, on the one hand, get this kind of tool that is far from perfect. You know, I can give you all the disclaimers and all the ways that this is, of course, a somewhat simplistic test. And yet it gets at something. It helps us, it helps us see the patterns in our thinking and start to understand these larger structures in how we make meaning and how we thereby give shape to our world.
Yeah, I really enjoy taking the test myself. They're very simple questions, but that's almost kind of part of the challenge is try not to think about it too hard and answer a question. And often like the answers aren't perfect, but you pick what, you know, fits best for you. And I just found the process of reflecting on these statements and these questions to be interesting, you know, learn a little bit about myself and then reflect on the results that we got. So again, for folks who want to do the worldview test, you can visit worldviewjourneys.com or wvtest.com.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a more direct one, but folks who want to check that out. So the test is a great place to start. It's a, like you said, it takes about 15 minutes. It's a good reflection. You get some interesting feedback. And then where can folks go from there if they now have some more information about themselves and how they view the world? How can they kind of dig in deeper, and what is there that folks can use to kind of expand their understanding?
Yes, great question. This is really what I've devoted, well, especially the last 5 years or so of my life to, because so I did this dissertation and got this fascinating insights about these different worldviews and how they relate to behavior and how they can help us, for example, understand a complex topic like climate change and environmental issues better. But then I realized, like, I want to actually use this in practice, like kind of, you know, how can we use this knowledge to, exactly as you say, become more aware of and more reflective of our worldview, and maybe even kind of expand or exchange, you know, evolve or change our worldviews in a positive direction. And what also happened is that I put this test online, and then actually teachers, this was so interesting, especially after I put it online the first year, I got a lot of emails from teachers who started telling me like, oh, I actually used this, I found your tool and I'm using it in my classrooms. And so this really, I got this light bulb experience like, oh yeah, it's actually more than, I mean, it is a research instrument, but it's maybe even more useful as an educational instrument, as you also said. It is a great way to just start the reflection process. And then in the last 5 years, I've started working with Utrecht University, where we are developing programs so that we can kind of go into a deeper process with this, with students. And I've really tried to develop these programs in a way that they're really universal and kind of broadly applicable, and helping people to dive in deeper. Yeah, so we developed this program. We focus initially on exploring our own worldview, getting a sense of our own worldview, and then also starting to exchange. So we have a lot of emphasis on dialogue, starting to exchange, especially with people who think differently. Something really interesting can happen when we have deeper dialogues, really dialogues from a place of curiosity with people who think differently. It's almost by itself, it will open up our worldview and it will make us more aware of how we think and why we think the way we think. And then we also introduce this element of kind of expansion. Can we put our worldview in a bigger context? And so this is a program that we developed that we then also researched So I'm talking here about we as me and my colleagues at Utrecht University that we researched and that we published on. And now we're also offering teacher training or facilitator training so that you can come if you want. We actually have a training running this spring. You can come online and go through this experience yourself that we have developed with students. Go through this experience yourself and then explore how you can use it in your own context, potentially as an educator, or as a trainer or a coach, change maker. There's many contexts where you can apply this.
Well, I think there's a great potential for using this concept, worldview, as we've been describing and discussing it. And one of the places that I really want to get a little more detail on, because we've focused on having productive civil dialogues about beliefs, and especially with people whose beliefs are different from ours. As we're communicating with people, how can we best listen intently and to infer that person's world view? And then how can we use this developing understanding of that other person's worldview to foster better communication with others?
These are good questions, and I think also very good questions for our time, right? This is such a hot topic societally. Yes. How can we infer other people's worldviews? Well, I think the more we start to kind of go on this journey of exploring our own worldview, also kind of understanding this framework in a little bit more depth, there's a lot of details there that will help us understand where certain positions in politics, for example, how they may be explained by underlying worldviews, and how they actually are quite often somewhat logically explained. Yeah, I like to talk of adopting a worldview lens. It's like almost like a pair of glasses that we put on, and when we put those glasses on, we start to see, and these are the assumptions someone is coming from in a debate or in a discussion or a dialogue, as you mentioned. And at the same time, of course, we want to just ask questions, right? We want to, instead of being stuck on that level that I also talked about before, where we're kind of, you know, debating the facts that we're probably never going to agree on anyway, because we live in different worlds and we live in different universes in a certain way now. So instead of debating these facts and arguing on that level, we can have dialogues where we really go deeper into, okay, I hear that's your position on, you know, again, abortion or on climate change or whatever hot topic you want to take or medium hot topic. And instead of staying on that level, we want to ask questions about not just what someone believes, but why they believe it. And just as importantly, how they've come to that belief. There's a story there, a human story. And that will start to unpack. That will start to show, like, oh, there's certain things that someone really values. And there are certain things there are certain convictions there that underlie this position. And this is also the domain where we can, and I've seen this again and again also with students. This is where it's easier actually to find agreement for us. And it's easier to also recognize the humanity in the other person. Because as soon as they start to talk, not just about the facts, but about the underlying values and the deeper convictions of why they've come to this belief, and this becomes much more relatable to us.
Bob and I have often talked about the power and really the importance of having curiosity, to be curious about things we don't understand or that might be different than our own beliefs or perspectives, or just to, you know, open-mindedness. If folks were curious to get to know, sometimes it's kind of scary and hard to start these conversations with people of different worldviews, different perspectives. I understand the website Worldview Journey has a cafe where people can interface and kind of talk about their different worldviews. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, we do all kinds of fun things. And one of them is what we started calling the Worldview Cafe. This is kind of spontaneously emerged. We use different dialogue techniques. And we had an online meeting with a group of people that had never met before. And I came together and we used this specific dialogue techniques, really with this intention also that you're talking about, the curiosity and to really listen and to really understand one another. And people came out just kind of feeling great and being high energy and like, wow, this was such a meaningful conversation. And this is also something I see a lot with the students. We decided right there, like, oh, we have to keep doing this. Let's make this a Worldview Cafe. This is a place where we meet online just to kind of hang out. We use prompts or questions. We go into small breakout rooms and we have conversations that we dig deeper in and that we really come from this place of inquiry, if you will, curiosity, and I kind of want to dig into why we see the things the way we see them, or why we have arrived at certain conclusions or ideas.
I think that's really great, because especially, you know, in the world as it is today, I'll just leave that on without comment. It can be kind of scary. You know, I have genuine curiosity and interest in why some people have the views that they have the beliefs that they have, why they do the things that they do. But it is a very polarized time. There's a lot of tension, you know, and it can be really kind of scary to, you know, want to talk about transgender people in sports or abortion, yes, or war, or, you know, all kinds of other like really things that can be very intense, you know. So yeah, it sounds like this is a really great venue, a safe venue for people who want to learn more about perspectives and to participate. It sounds like it's kind of structured as well.
Yes, and about the scary element, because that's also a perspective to consider there, is that we tend to identify, as humans, we tend to identify with our worldviews. And so when someone challenges our ideas, our conviction, this is not just abstract to us, right? It's just not just conceptual. They actually, in a certain way, challenge us. And so some people speak of this as worldview threats. We actually respond, and we see this, of course. Look at our political discussions and some of the topics you just mentioned. We see how we respond as if we're threatened, and how all kinds of mechanisms, and you know, actually the body's threat response can show up, and this influences our conversation in many different ways. And these are topics that are very existential to people, that are part of their identity, and that can evoke, therefore, a fear and a sense of threat and angst.
Seems like having a venue with structure and, like you said, like question prompts and stuff kind of creates an atmosphere where that can be a little bit more productive and people can maintain an open mind.
Yes, where we can break through those dynamics. And there's fascinating research that shows that when someone really listens to you, kind of offers you undivided attention and fully listens to you, you tend to, this is what is found in social psychology, you tend to depolarize. So you tend to become less extreme in your attitudes. It's amazing how these very actually simple structures, simple conversational structures, can break through these worldview threats dynamics and then put people at ease. And through that, putting people at ease, this kind of atmosphere of intimacy and listening allows them to start to reflect, rather than being in this defensive mode. I have to argue for why this is the only right way to see it. They can become more explorative. I mean, more like, oh, yeah, actually, why do I see it that way? And there, yeah, a kind of magic can happen, in my opinion.
I'm glad we're headed this deeply into this issue, because when I use the word infer, that's kind of what I meant, is you start out, someone says, no, I'm totally against abortion. The hard part now, or the challenge, is to not get involved in all the details of abortion, but to go below the surface there and see what the value, and you mentioned the values the person holds that makes them against abortion. And one of the ways that we've talked on this show about trying to understand another person's perspective, and really it's a counseling technique coming from Carl Rogers, active listening. So you're, yes, listening to what the person is saying, and then you're trying to go beneath the surface and see what is really the motivation for being against that or for it. What value is underneath that surface? And then you might say something like, it seems like, as I've been hearing you talk about abortion, that there is something that you really believe is sacred in human life that needs to be prized and preserved over some other right of woman to choose or a doctor to suggest as a treatment or whatever. So you restate your tentative idea of what you think is underlying that statement in terms of a value that the person holds. And then you listen to them. So it's this active listening, making a statement, paraphrasing, giving your impression on what is the underlying value there, and then listening for the accuracy. And so you do this active listening, make a statement, and then check it out for accuracy, and then restate it if need be, and continue doing that. And that also then fosters that listening and that going down of the defensiveness because the person is really being heard, and an attempt to understand because, like Julia said, we are really curious. I don't know how to describe it except it's a kind of a genuineness. If you've ever heard, and I've talked about Carl Rogers before, there are videotapes of him doing this. He was the master at doing this. You would just dissolve.
Yes.
You know, with Carl Rogers, he emanates with this genuine attempt to understand your world and to describe that, paraphrase it so that he is getting a closer and closer understanding of what you're talking about and the importance of your underlying values.
This beautiful curiosity is actually so therapeutic for us. Yeah. Wonderful.
We're getting somewhat short on time. We have a few more minutes to go, but I'm wondering, are there any other aspects of worldview that we haven't talked about that you think are important for listeners to hear?
Yeah, there are so many aspects that we haven't talked about. Well, I hope that people got a sense of where they can get started for themselves. Just take the test. I hope they got a little bit of sense of what worldviews actually are and how they show up in quite concrete ways, how they shape our world to a much greater degree than we tend to be aware of. I like the cultural historian Richard Tarnas said it the most succinctly. He said, worldviews create worlds. And I actually believe that, and not to make this the all-explanatory thing in the universe, but I do think that they provide us with an entrance point, therefore, also to make change, right? If they create our worlds and inform our worlds and shape our worlds, they provide an excellent entrance point to become more aware of what kind of worlds we are shaping and want to be shaping. And there's so much potential also in this domain of polarization, our relationship to others, cultural change.
And another thing that we like to do is to give our listeners resources for going beyond what they've heard on the episode here. And we have mentioned Worldview Journeys, and we're going to put the link to that on our webpage because there are a lot of resources on that. And you talked about the Worldview Cafe. You talked about facilitator training. Are there any other resources that we haven't talked about that you can point to?
Well, there's one thing that also could be, it's a little bit of a different pathway, but it may be also interesting for some of your listeners. And that's, I've developed a walk that I call the Existential Nature Walk. You can just download it on Spotify and get out in the woods or wherever, go walking into a nice place. And this walk it talks about worldviews but it focuses really on the topic of nature and our understanding of nature is one way. It's kind of one entrance point to go into this vast topic of worldviews. And it offers kind of a larger perspective on how humans have thought about nature over time and how that has changed and where perhaps that is going. And it offers an invitation for yourself to start exploring yeah, what is my relationship to nature? And it does that in a bit more embodied way, because you're walking out in the woods. And so you can actually have a bit of an inquiry process yourself while you're walking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, you know, walking around in nature, how do I relate? What is my nature view? What kind of perspective on nature did I grow up with?
That sounds really interesting. I like the mixing of the two. Could you tell us the name again and where folks can find it?
Yeah, so it's called The Existential Nature Walk, and it's on Spotify.
Sounds right up my alley. I'm going to have to check it out this weekend when I head to the woods.
Anip, one other thing. How can folks get your newsletter?
Yeah, so if you go to the website and you take the worldview test, it will ask you if you want to be subscribed. So that's then you have two in one. Or you can just go to the website. We've not been so aggressive in our marketing, so it's not popping up everywhere. You have to look a little bit for it. You need to scroll down a little bit, but it should be there also.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting things, so I'd recommend that to our listeners. So, Anip DeWitt, thank you so much for this discussion on worldviews. I've enjoyed it. I view worldviews as a secret sauce that makes up our personal philosophy and guides our beliefs and behaviors. It's such an important topic, especially in these polarized days. So on our Facebook page, we're going to link to your personal website at Anip DeWitt. That's AnnikDeWitt.com, and to the Worldview resource page at worldviewjourneys.com, and to that other site that Julia mentioned where they can take the Worldview test right off the bat and get results. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
No, I think that's it.
Thanks for joining us from the other side of the world.
Yeah, thank you so much for this conversation.
That's great. And so a happy Worldview journeying for our listeners. And thank you for your support. Send us a note and give us a little feedback about our episodes and some ideas for topics. Our email address is tc@kmud.org. And as always, Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking.
Clearly.